Hello, folks, and welcome to this, another episode of Socratic Citizen. I'm Patrick Cunningham, and it is Monday, January 18th, the year of our Lord, 2021. So I completely forgot that it was Martin Luther King's birthday today, until it was far too late to do anything meaningful in celebration thereof. So we're just going to quietly acknowledge Mr. King. Fortunately, I have some articles, quite by coincidence, about the whole race relations in the United States thing, which I'm sure Mr. King, or Dr. King, excuse me, let me not make the Jill Biden mistake here, though I think perhaps Mr. King, Dr. King, is more deserving. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. We're going to quietly acknowledge Dr. King today, and I have some good articles regarding race relations in the United States, which I think Dr. King would appreciate as the United States moves in the last few years further and further away from what you might call Dr. King's original dream for America and towards something rather darker and very much else. Now, before we do that, of course, we have to get into the comments and hear from what people out there in the world think about what we are doing here. So let's take a look at this. So this comes from YouTube, Friday's episode. This is from Dan Stewart, who we haven't heard from in a while. So hello, Dan, and welcome back. He says at 11:50 in the video from Friday, he says an analysis of political donations by party spanning 10 or more years may produce a misleading or incomplete impression. For example, while Goldman gave more to Republicans in the aggregate since 2007, my guess is the same analysis focusing on just the last 4 years would show a strong preference for Democrats. If true, I suspect that it's indicative of trends across the corporate sector. Well, that is an interesting take. Now, I don't know, first of all, that we can judge broad trends based on just the last 4 years. I think you may have to go back a little bit further to really see how things are going. Like, there's been a lot of stuff that's changed in the last 4 years. But I don't know. I kind of operate by this principle that things which show up very quickly tend to vanish very quickly as well. Things which, bam, appear out of nowhere don't tend to last a long time. Like, things that last a long time tend to show up slowly. They appear over a number of years. And so really big trends, I don't think they're going to come out of nowhere. So I don't know that the last 4 years, any trends that we would see in the last four years will be anything more than just the corporate sector responding to the rise of Donald Trump. And we really don't know what the long-term effects of the Trump presidency will be. Indeed, the Trump presidency could be the thing that pushes the United States over the edge into civil war. Thank you all for watching. This has been America. Or it could be the best thing that ever happened. Or it could be a blip and he will become about as forgotten as Warren Harding. I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows. So if anybody tells you they know, to quote The Princess Bride, they're probably selling something. But that's neither here nor there. The truth is, though, I tried to find some records of corporate donations by party, by corporations from 2016 to 2020. And I was not very successful. I found some stuff about individual people who had given a lot. I mean, I think the number one donor was actually that Sheldon Adelson, if I recall correctly, who gave primarily to Trump. So I don't know what Goldman Sachs has done over the last 4 years, but I don't think that anything they did over the last 4 years can be indicative of a broader trend. Now, keep in mind, however, that the analysis did already show a 60-40 preference for Democrats among the top 30 corporations, with the notable exception of Goldman Sachs. And excuse me. You should keep in mind that Goldman Sachs is not just donating to presidential races. Goldman Sachs is also donating to down-ticket races. One might say that the down-ticket races are almost more important, because who controls Congress is who will set the policies that Goldman Sachs, for example, has to operate under. Dodd-Frank and Glass-Steagall both came not from the president's pen nor his phone, but rather from Congress. So I appreciate where you're coming from, and most of the people in the chat agreed with you that there was a preference for Democrats in general in the institutions at large. We had one person who disagreed, Public Citizen, but I don't know. We haven't heard from Public Citizen since I did that. And Public Citizen did not deign to join us for the segment that I did on the subject that Public Citizen suggested. So we'll have to wait and find out until they go watch the old archive show, if indeed they are so kind as to do so. Now, the other thing that we talked about on Friday that I wanted to kind of follow up on was we had somebody named Death Punk or Death Bazooka or something like that. I don't remember the name. Said, you know, F lockdowns. And we had a couple people in the chat say, listen, man, 400,000 people in the United States have died of COVID-19. I don't know that you can really be saying bad things about lockdowns. Like, we need this. We have to do whatever we can. And so I knew somewhere in the back of my brain, in my mental mind, that there was something wrong with that. Because I could have sworn that I had heard, mostly from somebody smarmy on the right, talking about, oh my God, can you believe it? This new study came out and it says that lockdowns don't even work. And to be fair, the World Health Organization has been saying for several months now that lockdowns are not the ideal way to fight the virus. And I'm inclined to agree, both because I was questioning the efficacy of the technique itself, but also because I recognize that, like, I've been reading Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. He's a conservative economist. I like the way he writes, and also F.A. Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. But really, specifically, it's the way these economists think, where nothing is ever just one thing. There's always secondary and tertiary, even, I don't know the word, quaternary, levels of blowback or levels of effect that don't normally get looked at when we look at policies like lockdown. And so a lot of people, specifically those who don't like lockdown anyway, because as we've talked about, people like to mostly make up rationalizations for the things they wanted anyway. There's been a lot of arguments from these people who don't really like lockdowns, that there's a lot of consequences to lockdowns that just don't get talked about very much. All we talk about is, oh my God, people dying, lock everything down because we're doing something about this. When in fact, it would make more sense to take a more measured approach and say, what can we do specifically that's going to be most effective? Not what's going to make us feel like we're doing the most. Because I think to some extent, there's a performative aspect to these lockdowns. There's a performative aspect of we're hiding in our house because it's dangerous outside. Which is a little bit, I think, of maybe like an amygdala level response instead of a high IQ prefrontal cortex response. And so I would encourage people to use more of the rational part of the brain than the howling, murdering, raping baboon part of the brain. And I think that lockdowns are more a howling, raping baboon part of the brain. We're afraid, it's dangerous out there, everyone hide in your house, and the government is gonna make sure that you do it. So this study that I found here, this is assessing mandatory stay-at-home and business closure effects on the spread of COVID-19, came out about a month ago, a little under a month ago, actually more like 3 weeks ago, and it details a analysis of the past year, countries that used lockdowns, countries that didn't use lockdowns, countries that used lockdowns at some point versus at another point. And it basically measures the results. And it is an academic study. I know it says accepted article over here. Basically, this article has been accepted for publication, but has not been officially published yet. But I guess some journalists got a hold of it, started talking about it, and then I found it. So now it's on this show. So it's getting probably more eyes on it from amateurs like me looking at it and trying to figure out what all these fancy words mean than it's ever going to get in whatever journal it ends up published in. So let's take a look at what it actually says. So, from the background and aims of the abstract of this study. So, we're looking at restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions. So, these are NPIs. Good morning, public citizen. We will get to comments here in just a moment. Let me go through the study. So, we have two kinds of restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions. We have more restrictive, so MRNPIs, and less restrictive, LRNPIs. And so from the results here, it says implementing any NPIs was associated with significant reductions in case growth. Okay, fantastic. In 9 out of 10 study countries, fantastic. That 1 out of 10 is Spain, and based on what I read in here, the results from Spain make no sense. Spain, regardless of what they did, it did not seem to have any effect at all, no matter what. Even regardless whether you're looking at more restrictive NPIs, a.k.a. lockdowns, as opposed to less restrictive NPIs, a.k.a. social distancing guidelines, canceling concerts, that sort of thing. So this is from the study. This is Stanford University. January 6th, 2021, we find no clear significant beneficial effect of more restrictive NPIs on case growth in any country. In France, the effect of MRNPIs was plus 7% when compared with Sweden and plus 13% when compared with South Korea. Positive means pro-contagion. So in France, the effect of more restrictive NPIs versus Sweden was plus 7% pro-contagion. I'm assuming that they're measuring the growth of cases because I don't remember off the top of my head. This is a very lengthy study, okay? And I am not a doctor. I'm basically reading the parts that I do understand and extrapolating into the parts that I don't understand and hoping that if I'm wrong, that either no one will notice or someone will correct me. So, same thing here when compared with South Korea, which had an extremely effective COVID response, although they did not engage in the kind of lockdowns you saw in Europe. They actually engaged. I actually did some separate reading about this. They did some very, very serious contact tracing, really intense contact tracing. I don't know that Americans would go along with the kind of contact tracing they did in South Korea, but it looks like from the results that that is the approach that works. So while small benefits, they conclude, cannot be excluded, we do not find significant benefits on case growth of more restrictive NPIs. Similar reductions in case growth may be achievable with less restrictive interventions. So the early adoption of these more restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions in early 2020 was justified, they say, because of the rapid spread of the disease, overwhelmed health systems in some hard-hit places, and substantial uncertainty about the virus's morbidity and mortality. So basically looking at this, it's like early on when you don't really know what you're dealing with, then something like a lockdown makes sense, even though in retrospect we realize looking back it has not had the greatest effect on the actual transmission rate, at least according to this particular study. Now, they're going to address some of the other studies that were done back in 2020 that purported to show a clear correlation between lockdown measures and contagion rates, or I should say a clear inverse correlation between lockdown measures and contagion rates. The more lockdowns, the less contagion. In other words, so because of the potential harmful health effects of more restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions, this is what I was talking about a moment ago, including hunger, opioid-related overdoses, missed vaccinations, increase in non-COVID diseases from missed health services, domestic abuse, mental health, suicidality, as well as a host of economic consequences with health implications, it is increasingly recognized that their postulated benefits deserve careful study. And here we go. I think this is probably the most cited study from last year. I remember looking at it and being suspicious because I'm like, this appears to be based on simulated models of case growth. But anyway, they know more than I do, so let's defer to them. And they say one prominent modeling analysis estimated that across Europe, MRNPIs, more restrictive, aka lockdowns, accounted for 81% of the reduction in the effective reproduction number, a measure of disease transmission. However, in the absence of empirical assessment of the policies, their effects on reduced transmission are assumed rather than assessed. This is what I was talking about. It's based on simulations or based on models as opposed to based on the actual empirical evidence, which after a year of dealing with COVID, we now have, which these studies did not. So basically, this is just to look at how they actually did, how they actually drew out what the results of the more restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions were. And they just said effects of more restrictive NPIs plus less restrictive NPIs plus epidemic dynamics, the known facts about how the disease moves in the absence of any non-pharmaceutical interventions, minus the effects of all of those things except for more restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions. Deceptively simple. But anyway, so that is the study. As far as I can tell, it seems that the general opinion in general across experts and government officials has started to shift. And indeed, even Andrew Cuomo was on Twitter, I think 2 weeks ago, saying, look, guys, it's time to open up the economy. If we don't do it now, we're not going to have anything left to open up. All right, so let's get to these couple comments here. So Public Citizen says, are you becoming a COVID truther? Well, it depends on what you mean by truther. I am always a truther because I believe in the truth. As far as COVID truther, I don't know. I don't go in for conspiracy theories. So COVID is a bioweapon and China is making war on us using COVID. Probably not, I would say. Is COVID made up in order to bring about some kind of world government? Probably not. Is the risk of COVID perhaps overblown? I would say probably yes, not because of any grand conspiracy, but because of what we've talked about here on the show before, which is that media outlets in general profit from controversy and catastrophe. Now, there's also some stuff that I was reading about the reliability of the test that's used and then some of the percentages of like other diseases, things like the flu that kind of vanished and we don't really know why the flu has gone down 98% between 2020 and 2019. So I'm inclined to think that there are some false positives in there, but I'm not inclined to say that I know how many. It's tempting to look at this and go, oh, look, the flu is here, but it's being, but we think that many of these flu cases are actually COVID cases. So, but again, I don't know. I can only say what I suspect. Really, this discussion is not about, though, is COVID real or is it an evil alien conspiracy? The discussion is really about, are lockdowns the most effective way to deal with the COVID pandemic? Because we were talking yesterday about that. And I'm inclined to see lockdowns as more risky because of the stuff they talked about here, all of these other potential harmful health effects. So in the absence of really compelling evidence that they like work better than anything else, I would say avoid lockdowns wherever possible. And then further, Public Citizen says that data doesn't seem to factor in mask usage, which would make the difference for either more or less restrictive responses. I would be inclined to believe that mask usage would be classified under less restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions. Because they listed them somewhere in here, I don't remember where, but they said social distancing guidelines, hand washing guidelines, all there's a whole list of things. And it's like governments recommending this, Sweden banning large public gatherings, so concerts, music festivals, movie theater. I don't know about movie theaters. Maybe, maybe not. But in general, taking precautions other than lockdowns. So I would be inclined to agree. Mask usage probably would make the difference for either more or less restrictive responses, but I think mask usage is already factored in as one of the less restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions. It would be kind of weird for them to completely forget about mask wearing. Public Citizen says you need to be careful when you say the scientific consensus says time to open up. I don't believe that is an accurate statement. The details of how to open are what matters. Well, I did not mean to say the scientific consensus, because that is a very specific term. Like, that is like a term of the art, which means that multiple studies, multiple scientists have done their own research and have independently come to the same conclusions, that we have had multiple rounds of testing of a particular hypothesis, and we have failed to reject that hypothesis, and so as a result, it starts to pass from hypothesis into theory, which is, in other words, the best that we know, right? We haven't found any credible evidence that this theory doesn't work. So I don't mean scientific consensus. I meant more like public consensus, or the consensus of even public-facing medical people. But I don't know, the scientific consensus, you're right, that's a dangerous term. We shouldn't use it unless it really is warranted. I'm talking about this study. I'm talking about the World Health Organization saying only use lockdowns as an absolute last resort because of the other stuff that comes along with them, the depression, the increased mortality and morbidity for other diseases and other health problems, a lot of people missing cancer treatments, so on and so forth, and of course, the questions around their efficacy. So it's a complicated question. And so, like, COVID truthers, like the people I think you're referring to, make the classic mistake. Like H.L. Mencken said, for every problem, there is a solution that is clear, simple, and wrong. And very often, especially when you get lay people trying to talk about complex scientific things, the temptation is always to go for the solution that is simple and clear and wrong. So perhaps the most important thing we can do here is to remember that this is a very complex problem requiring probably a complex solution. So I would count myself in the camp of people who are kind of standing around going, all right, let's make sure that we don't like screw up a bunch of other stuff when we're dealing with COVID. I am one of those annoying people standing athwart the scientific community yelling, stop, to borrow a phrase from William Buckley. So anyway, let's move on to our next segment here. I have some stuff that's actually kind of fun. So as long as we're talking COVID, we got to talk about COVID vaccines. And as long as we're talking COVID vaccines, we got to talk about this guy. This is from The Independent. Ultra-Orthodox rabbi tells followers that the COVID vaccine can turn people gay. He's been watching Alex Jones, I think, and he doesn't think it's just confined to fluoride and the frogs. We all remember Alex Jones telling us that the fluoride was turning the frogs gay. So anyway, an ultra-Orthodox rabbi, The Independent says, has told his followers to avoid getting a COVID vaccine because it can, quote, make them gay. Israeli media reported that Rabbi Daniel Asor, who has amassed a large online following, also claimed inoculation efforts were part of a, quote, global malicious government trying to, quote, establish a new world order. So I think this would be a COVID truther, or maybe a vaccine truther. So while his claim of a link between the vaccine and homosexuality is factually incorrect, it also contradicts statements from leading Orthodox rabbis who have called on their followers to come forward for a coronavirus jab. According to news outlet Israel Yahom, Mr. Asor used a recent sermon to claim, quote, any vaccine made using an embryonic substrate, and we have evidence of this, causes opposite tendencies. Vaccines are taken from an embryonic substrate, and they did that here too, so it can cause opposite tendencies, seemingly referring to homosexuality. And of course, responding to his comments, LGBT plus rights group Havruta joked that it was, quote, currently gearing up to welcome our impending new members. So my question would be, of course, if you are already gay, and you take the vaccine, Would it turn you into a heterosexual? And if so, how long before Christian groups, radical evangelical Christian groups, change their minds about vaccine truthiness and decide to give the vaccine to their recalcitrant teenage sons and daughters? We'll have to see how this plays out. But anyway, a lot of people take their resistance to what we might call more restrictive non-pharmaceutical interventions rather further than people like me who just turn on a microphone and start yelling into it about our opinions. Lawrence Fox, the actor, was condemned for wearing a COVID mask, quote, exemption badge. So he's been criticized after posting a photo of himself wearing a mask exemption badge, which he claims he bought on Amazon. He is an actor turned activist who is vocally against government lockdown rules, and he appeared to suggest that he could not wear a face mask as he suffered from anxiety. So he posted a selfie of himself, what else could a selfie be of, along with the caption, quote, after a long period of consultation with myself, an extended review period, and proper due diligence conducted with myself, I've received the badge that I ordered from Amazon. I am surprised that Amazon is actually selling these things. I would think you would need like a doctor's note to get one of these. Thanks for being there for me. Hashtag anxiety. So he's trying to cheat, basically, trying to claim anxiety exempts him from mask wearing. And as much as I'm sure we would all like to be exempted from mask wearing, most of us would prefer to be exempted from mask wearing because the virus went away, not because we ordered something on Amazon. But yeah, so actually this fits in with my episodic theme today, whose life matters. We'll get to the literal whose life matters topic here in just a second. So to change course just a little bit, because these are indeed quick takes, I just want to look at this real quick because we talked about this for a lot last week. British Columbia Supreme Court allows Twitter to be sued for defamation. So this is going to be interesting. The Supreme Court of British Columbia decided on Thursday that it has jurisdiction to take on a case by billionaire philanthropist Frank Giustra against Twitter over defamatory tweets made on the platform, which, quote, allege involvement in a supposed conspiracy known as Pizzagate. Well, it's not a supposed conspiracy. It is a conspiracy, or at least it's a conspiracy theory, and it's not a theory because it has the backing of scientific consensus, but rather because it is a theory about conspiracies, theory used in the more mainstream lay people kind of sense. So Giustra is a billionaire businessman living in Vancouver who brought a defamation case against Twitter after being accused of being involved in a pedophilia ring by promoters of the Pizzagate conspiracy theory. The theory alleges that a number of high-profile business leaders and politicians, I think Pizzagate, and I think we've talked about this, actually was the roots of the QAnon theory, that it kind of grew out of Pizzagate or something like that. You know, you leave pizza in the oven too long, you forget about it, you come back, stuff is growing in it. And so we left Pizzagate in the oven too long, and now QAnon is growing in it, to use perhaps a tortured metaphor. But either way, I'm not sure what the ramifications of this are. I know that if we come to a place where Twitter can suddenly be sued all the time for defamation, that, I mean, a lot of people, I think the Electronic Frontier Foundation talked about this, a lot of people believe that Twitter and Facebook will end up going out of business, that social media will kind of die because there's just too much being uploaded, too many people posting, they can't watch all of it, and they also can't fact check every single post. And so at some point, they're going to have to just go, we can't do this anymore, unless they get some kind of defamation protection. Indeed, such people argue, Section 230 is literally the foundation upon which all social media is built, because there's just too much liability otherwise for this kind of lawsuit. And this goes back to what I was talking about before, with a backlash against the kind of big tech dominance of so many aspects of our lives today. But on a more whimsical note, Donald Trump has been trying to have another military-style parade, this one to send him off into the great golf course in the great beyond. Not that he's dying, he's just leaving public life, I would imagine, and probably the public eye for quite some time. But the Pentagon says no. I would not be surprised if Nancy Pelosi was whispering in their ear, don't give this guy anything. But because she already tried to have them take the nuclear codes away from Trump while he was still president. So the Pentagon rejects the president's request for a huge military-style farewell parade with a crowd of supporters hours before Biden's inauguration. President Donald Trump's? Always weird to me when I find this kind of stuff. It also makes me feel smart. So he wants a military-style farewell parade as he exits office on Wednesday to include a massive crowd of his supporters. Two senior defense officials' offices insist that the Pentagon will not participate in any such event. We will not be doing this. So he's leaving in the morning, and we've got 20,000 members of the National Guard deployed. So I think the Pentagon was saying, look, man, be serious. We've got security concerns out the wazoo here, and you want to have a parade. We're not doing it. The security risks are just too great. I suppose Trump could pretend that the 20,000 members of the National Guard are there to see him off, as I suppose, in a way, they are. And of course, we have to talk a little bit, at least momentarily, about updates on the impeachment. It looks like they're going to try and go forward with an impeachment trial, although Trump will be out of office shortly after it begins. I believe it's supposed to begin tomorrow when the Senate reconvenes. But Alan Dershowitz, tells Newsmax.com that the Senate cannot put Citizen Trump on trial. Sounds like the name of a good movie, Citizen Trump. So Harvard law professor and constitutional law expert Alan Dershowitz said the Senate does not have the jurisdiction to put Citizen Trump on trial. So in an interview on Fox News Sunday Morning Futures, or no, Newsmax reports that Dershowitz told Fox, excuse me, I missed this the first time around. So Dershowitz argued the impeachment of President Donald Trump is unconstitutional. There is no jurisdiction. In other words, once he leaves office, he is just a citizen and cannot be tried by the Senate. He would have to be tried by a regular court of law because he is up on January 20th at like 11:07 a.m., whatever time it is, no longer the president. He is just some dude. So if you could do that, Dershowitz said, it would be putting someone on trial who is not a sitting president, and implications would be horrendous, he said. If you can impeach anyone who is not a sitting president, there are no limits to the power of Congress to try ordinary citizens, he added. It's plainly unconstitutional, and the Senate should not proceed with this unconstitutional act. And so I think that perhaps Mr. Dershowitz is kind of, to some extent, I think he's playing to the camera, kind of coming up with the most horrifying possible outcome, going, oh my God, if we let them do this, next thing you know, they'll be just impeaching random people, and we'll have show trials, and Stalin will rise from the grave to take over from Joe Biden. But we all know that this is unlikely. Really, the question is whether the constitutional authority exists. And I know a lot of people don't like Dershowitz, but I think that we can agree that he is at least a good lawyer. He has not gone down the Rudy Giuliani / Sidney Powell road into insanity. He does still appear to, at least appear to, have 2 feet planted squarely on the ground. But he is not the only lawyer involving themselves in Trump's affairs lately. As the Daily Mail reports, Fulton County, which is right down the street from me, the Fulton County District Attorney is considering an inquiry into alleged Trump election interference. So Trump is facing a criminal investigation into election interference in Fulton County, Georgia, after he called Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and demanded he, quote, find 11,780 votes. And they report Donald Trump may have violated at least three separate Georgia laws, particularly when he called Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. A member of the state's election board is hoping for a referral by mid-February. If Trump were charged by the Fulton County DA, it would not be within the bounds of a presidential pardon, instead needing one from the governor, who seems unlikely to give one, given the relationship lately between the Georgia state government and the Trump team. And this is the second possible investigation into Trump that exceeds pardon power. The first, of course, being the charges related to tax fraud or tax evasion from the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James. So I have to say, this feels a little political. This does not feel like people conscientiously upholding the law. Indeed, it feels almost like a bit of a thumb in the eye of all the people who claimed election fraud in the other direction. Like, not only are we not going to humor you and your accusations, we're going to level accusations the other way. So maybe they think they're going to cancel out Trump's accusations. Maybe they, I don't know what really people are thinking here, but we talked about this. It was shady for Trump to call Raffensperger, but we should keep in mind that Trump legitimately does think he won the election. Like, we've known this guy as president for 4 years. Look deep within yourself. He really thinks he won the election. This is not a grift. This is Trump really believing that there's no way he could just have not been reelected. It had to be fraud as far as he's concerned. And I think that mitigates the idea that he's election interfering. If he wants Raffensperger to make up votes, that to me is a clear violation. If he's just crazy and thinks he won, that's different. It's maybe a little, just as troubling, but it's less criminal, at least to my way of thinking. So let's talk a little bit here about the actual reason I wanted to name the episode what I named it. And this is the first of a couple stories. So California City has removed a White Lives Matter banner, calling it vandalism, as the New York Post reports. So the white banner with black lettering was hung between two poles at a busy city intersection, but was taken down soon after city officials became aware of it. So they ordered the removal of this White Lives Matter banner that was posted on city property, calling it racist and a despicable act of vandalism. So the incident happened in Union City, blah, blah, blah. So a lot of people are very concerned that people are going to think that California City is some kind of like haven of white supremacy, that it had something to do with the weekend of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Maybe it did. I don't know. I have not been in contact with whoever it was that hung the poster. But the reason I want to talk about this, because I know the White Lives Matter thing is really does have a reputation for coming from white supremacists or from racists, or at the very least from people who don't like Black Lives Matter, like really don't like Black Lives Matter, not people who have like ideological differences with the particular method of their analysis of whatever, like people are like, ah, I don't know, black people, whatever. So white supremacist slogan adopted in response to the Black Lives Matter movement. Proud Boys leader Henry Enrique Tarrio pleaded not guilty to charges in connection with the burning of a Black Lives Matter banner. So, and then in June, President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reportedly ordered the removal of a Black Lives Matter banner from outside the U.S. Embassy in South Korea that was posted soon after the May 25th death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. So the only conclusion that I can come to from this, and the answer to the question that I ask in the title of this episode, is that I think perhaps no lives matter, or I also came up with this one, and I think this is particularly good. Only my life matters. And I think that in our age today, the me millennium, as I think Time Magazine called it back in 2000, is most appropriately encapsulated by this, my new campaign, for people to care more about me. But anyway, on the subject of Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, No Lives Matter, or Only My Life Matters, we have the reputable Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proposes funding to deprogram white supremacists. There's nothing creepy about using the phrase deprogram at all. However you may feel about white supremacists, please do not start programming or deprogramming anyone. We're already in the uncanny valley as it is with the rise of artificial intelligence. Please do not beat this horse anymore, lest it run us over. So there are people who are radicalized right now, she said at a town hall. So the federal government needs to fund the deprogramming of white supremacists and conspiracy theorists. So I would go so far as to say that in addition to saying that they need to fund the deprogramming of white supremacists, they also need to defund the programming of white supremacists, i.e. the racist tendencies of police forces. That's my wordplay for today. So the white supremacist cause is futile, she said. It's nihilist. So we don't need to know who she represents. We all know who she is. Quote, their world will never exist. That's why we're seeing violence right now, she said, speaking in the wake of the violent siege on the U.S. Capitol by radical supporters of President Trump. Now, she also said, to be fair, half the house was almost close to almost dying, which maybe she's going a little over the top here, I think. So Ocasio-Cortez said the House Subcommittee on Civil Rights she serves on has held hearings over the prior 2 years on white supremacy and said there are programs to, quote, de-radicalize brainwashed adherents. But funding was not a priority for those programs. What is she talking about? What does this mean? She's speaking in this very general language, which makes me think that maybe these programs don't really exist, or maybe they're really lame, like we're going to buy a bunch of billboards that say black people are cool and that's going to somehow deprogram white supremacists. Or are we talking about some kind of like creepy psychological warfare here? What is a program to de-radicalize a brainwashed adherent of white supremacy? What does that mean? I am nervous about this. All right, because this is the same lady who was saying we need Congress to rein in the media. She does not seem to understand the role of Congress in the United States. So the one smart thing she said is that this is not going to go away on January 20th, referring to the people who Trump kind of rode, the wave of people that Trump rode into the White House. They're not going away on January 20th. So, and then, of course, to move into our final topic, and before we read some comments here, I'm a big fan of Jimmy Dore. He's probably my favorite progressive pundit. But he has a habit of going on Tucker Carlson because I guess he likes Carlson. He's really not a purity test kind of guy. He's not an ideological kind of guy. I get the sense that he does genuinely care like about the downtrodden of the world, and that's why he does the things that he does. But so he's been on Tucker Carlson repeatedly, and he's been pushing this pardon Assange thing, which I could not be any more happy about. I love looking at all sides of all issues. The one issue I have a hard time looking at all sides of is freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, journalism. That kind of whole area to me is very one-sided. You're either on the government side or you're on the people's side. So I am very unreasonable when it comes to this topic. But Jimmy Dore goes on Tucker Carlson because he knows that Trump watches that show. And he's saying, look, man, let me see if I can find the quote. Here we go. The first person, this is Jimmy Dore on Tucker Carlson's show. The first person to be deplatformed was WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Indeed, Amazon did to WikiLeaks exactly the same stuff they did to Parler. A great way, Jimmy says, for Donald Trump to stick the thumb back in the eye of these people is to pardon Julian Assange. If he knows what's good for freedom of speech and freedom of the press, he should pardon Julian Assange. I am so happy to hear this. This is why I love Jimmy. He doesn't care about going on Tucker. He doesn't care about trying to get Trump to do something. He's happy to do business with Trump if Trump is going to do good stuff. He's not going to be so wrapped up in, oh my God, it's President Trump, that he just refuses to talk to them at all. But of course, people hit back and they don't they don't like this kind of stuff. They're like, oh, you can't go on Tucker Carlson. So you see here, this is a tweet from Emma Vigeland. Tucker isn't a dummy. He knows that investing in a, quote, leftist who's driving a wedge in the left is good for his far-right agenda. It also helps when all that leftist does is attack Democrats and ignore fascism. Perfect guest for his ends. So this has been a long time thing for people like Jimmy Dore, but we are coming up on a hard stop here. So let's read some comments before I run out of time to read them at all. So we have crying faces from Public Citizen. I believe this is in reference to the vaccines turning people gay, or at least the Orthodox rabbi thinking so. It is strange that what people come up with here. Public Citizen says, I had a guy come to my discussion group who is giving away these badges. He has a meetup group and has tons of followers. Guess what he is politically? If you guess libertarian, you win. Well, I know that libertarians get a really bad reputation because, okay, I talked about this before. Every group has their crazies. Okay, the Republicans have the white supremacists, the Democrats have the woke mafia and the Marxists, the, you know, authoritarians, of course, have the Stalinists, the Nazis, so on and so forth. And then the libertarians have Vermin Supreme, the guy with the boot on his head, and then they have the radical anarcho-capitalist, I hate the government, kill government officials, so on and so forth. I get the feeling that maybe this guy falls into one of those slightly crazy categories, but the problem with the libertarian side of the political spectrum is that it's not very heavily populated. And so the crazies tend to get as a much larger voice. And the, it has a similar problem to what I think doctrinal Marxism does, which is that it's theoretically a very cool idea. And so it attracts a lot of very intellectual people who are pretty good at making their case, but it's a very theoretical kind of doctrine. Like hard theoretical Marxism would be very difficult to implement in real life. Hard theoretical libertarianism would be very difficult to implement in real life. So, but then there's also people who just hate authority, who just don't want to be told what to do. And I think maybe that is probably the most likely political orientation of this guy you bring up here. Erg Dershowitz is such a partisan hack, probably based in his shared Trump connection to Epstein Island. Well, okay, this sounds like a lot of conspiracy theories here. I don't even think we can talk anymore. I think I'm going to become a liberal pundit and you're going to become Tucker Carlson, but I'm not going to be Jimmy Dore with you. But no, I don't know. Dershowitz, he may be a partisan hack. I'm not so sure about that. I feel like he's the kind of guy who you can very much dislike, but still look at him and go, this guy is good at what he does. He is obviously a highly intelligent guy, and I think he does know a lot about the Constitution. And he was Trump's lawyer the first time around through his first impeachment, so he may be playing a big role here coming up soon, depending on what Trump decides to do and what the Senate decides to do as regards impeachment. Public Citizen says white pride is a very different meaning than black pride. For example, once Trump is gone, it's going to be a lot easier to get beyond all this hyper-focus on race and racism. Well, I don't know about that. I know that Trump gets this reputation as kind of a race-baiting president, but I don't know that Trump is really creative enough to get credit for actually doing that. I think that existed already because, I mean, let's keep in mind, Black Lives Matter formed under President Obama. There was a lot of racial division under President Obama as well that was not, that I don't think really changed under Trump. It's just the guy in charge changed. It went from someone who was largely sympathetic to the goals of Black Lives Matter to Trump and his ilk who were taking down Black Lives Matter flags from embassies. So I'm not so sure about we can get away from the hyper-focus on race and racism. I think it might be driven by other stuff. Dan Stewart says, Jimmy Dore is a socialist of the Democrat variety. I'm not sure entirely what you mean by that. I mean, I was going to say he's like an old-school socialist. Like, I can see him, like, in the 1930s, like organizing workers to go on strike or something. Or he's the guy that FDR is trying to shut up with all the New Deal programs, right? Who was the guy running for the socialist on the socialist ticket against FDR? I don't remember. But that's Jimmy Dore, historically, right there. Public Citizen says, Jimmy Dore loves to attack Democrats. That's all he is good at. All right, hold that thought, because we have a couple minutes here. I have one cool piece from Jacobin we're going to look at here in a second about this, that is specifically on this subject of Jimmy Dore loves to attack Democrats, although it's not about Jimmy Dore. Dan Stewart says, is it racist to say all Black lives matter? It probably is, because we both know what you're doing there. We both know the game that you're playing. So the thought police are not interested in your creative collage of lives matter, amalgams of words in the interest of suggesting. I'm guessing what you're saying is, for example, Black Lives Matter does not take into account the, like, criminal deaths from Black Lives. Criminal deaths from Black Lives. There is a sentence I should write for the Daily Mail. They do not take into account all Black lives, i.e. certain times when, or certain causes of death for Black people are left unaddressed. They seem entirely focused on deaths at the hands of the police, which is an argument I've heard before. It's not a crazy argument. I think to some extent, Black Lives Matter got a little caught up in the fundraising game, and now they do, you know, what works, as opposed to what's likely to be, you know, philosophically correct. So, but yes, that is racist, and you will be canceled. So get ready for that. Ethan Hartman says, Satan is really good at what he does, too. Okay, I don't suppose I can argue with that. I would be interested to perhaps hear some more specifics as to what you are referring to. So Tucker, Dan Stewart says, Tucker has expressed sentiments that Dore would very much appreciate, i.e. restricting the use of AI to save U.S. trucker jobs. See interview with Shapiro. I am not familiar with that interview, though that is a topic we should perhaps look at. I think I want to do an episode on this. Restricting the use of artificial intelligence to save U.S. trucker jobs. Interesting. Ethan Hartman says, Trump is playing for the crowd. That still says a lot about who supports him. Well, I think Trump was playing for the crowd the whole time. I don't think that Trump knows how to do anything else. That's what he is. That's who he is. He's still the game show host president. He's still doing The Apprentice, but now it's the president. Who wants to bet that he was in the Oval Office looking at one of the many people that he fired over the course of his administration and going, you fired. Don't make fun of my Trump imitation. I don't believe in Trump imitations because no one can do that voice. But who wants to bet he did the you're fired thing from The Apprentice in the Oval Office? Of course he did. That was the whole thing with Trump. There's nothing to him except playing to the crowd. Ethan Hartman says, Eugene Debs. That is right. Eugene Debs. I love Eugene Debs. I talked about him. I talked about his prison speech. As long as there is a soul in prison, I can never be free. As long as there's a criminal element, I am in it. As long as there's a lower class, I am of it. I love that guy. He is awesome. He reminds me of Jimmy Dore to some extent. Someone who really has the courage of their convictions, who is hated by people on his own side, the left, as much as by people on the right, or more than by people on the right. Because I think, because I like Jimmy Dore and I like Eugene Debs, that they both represent kind of a more, not ideologically pure, but you might say like spiritually pure. Their intentions are extremely pure, I would say. Juniper Smoke says, I'm all tuckered out, to be honest. That is just hilarious. Are you watching a lot of Tucker Carlson? Because I'll be honest, I don't really watch any Tucker Carlson. So when he does come around, I can be like, oh, well, this is interesting. Let's see what old Tucker is up to. He also reminds me, he looks like some of the really preppy guys that I went to high school with. So I feel like I'm watching one of the popular preppy kids do a show about Trump. So that just adds an extra level of hilarity for me. So let's go into our last segment here, because I am very short on time, and I very much want to talk about this. So this is from Jacobin, the socialists over at Jacobin, and they write, this is about Steve Bannon mostly, but it's going to touch on the Jimmy Dore attacking Democrats thing. Far-right intellectuals are offering workers a rotten deal, it says. So this is Jacobin, the socialists at Jacobin, differentiating themselves from what you might call the nationalist socialists, hopefully not the national socialists, of the far right, the Steve Bannons of the quote-unquote far right, depending on how far you're willing to look for legitimate political positions. So in the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election, Steve Bannon was widely credited as the mastermind behind Donald Trump's win. Glowing profiles in mainstream outlets followed, a fact that was apparently on Trump's mind when he removed the Breitbart propagandist from his White House perch as chief strategist. It was perhaps not surprising that a man as fundamentally driven by vainglory and lucre as Trump would eventually come to cross purposes with Bannon. See there, Ethan Hartman, this is what I'm talking about. Somebody who's as fundamentally driven by vainglory. I think that's not a bad analysis of Trump. He would eventually come to cross purposes with Bannon, who, for all his credentials as a showbiz pundit, often aspired to be something like the intellectual, indeed spiritual, sage of right-wing populism. This remarkable tension between hyper-real sensationalism, I'm guessing that's Trump, and the spiritualist sensationalism are brought to the fore in Benjamin Teitelbaum's excellent new book, War for Eternity. In theory, this is a book review, but I'm not reading the whole book on the show, all right? Because we don't do nine-hour episodes. My voice would not last that long. So one of the key things that comes away from Teitelbaum's ethnography is the idiosyncrasy and indeed conceptual irreconcilability of the different strands on the far right. So we've all seen this sort of thing, right? You have people show up to these right-wing rallies, and you've got people carrying Confederate flags, you've got people with tattoos of Odin, you've got the kind of alt-light, as I've heard it called, the diet alt-right, as I would say, which would be something like the Proud Boys. And then you'll also have, for example, anti-government people like the Boogaloo Boys, who are not really Trump supporters, and they're hardly fascists. They're more like the hardcore libertarians that Public Citizen was talking about, who just hate the government, want to go back to the Constitution of 1789, and really like turn back the clock on how American government functions, if not also on how American culture functions. So we're going to look at a couple of these different strands, and then Jacobin's going to tell us why the left is very similar, but in every way better, and I'm going to politely disagree with them. So the traditionalist intellectuals are a motley collection of self-taught New Age spiritualists, fringe academics, online culture warriors, cleaned-up skinheads, neo-fascists, former Russian state philosophers, though they only mention actually one of these, and I think there only is one of them, and more. Some, like Alexander Dugin, Vladimir Putin's state philosopher, and Biden himself, are well-known and enjoy something of a rock star status on the far right. Others, like the Brazilian online troll Olavo de Carvalho and the disgraced former academic Jason Giorgiani, are less well known. I don't really know a lot about these guys either, but it's not really important for the purposes of this episode. They hold widely divergent views on a variety of issues. Bannon is staunchly pro-America and anti-China, while Dugin favors a new anti-Western Russo-Chinese alliance. Okay, this is where I think you start to see that Jacobin maybe doesn't fully understand what they're talking about. Like, I was reading, or actually I was listening to, the Robert Paxton's Anatomy of Fascism, and he was talking about how socialism, it really lends itself to internationalist movements. You can have the Workers' International, right? Fascism does not lend itself to internationalism because it's inevitably tied to the particular circumstances of a particular time and place. It's very nationalist insofar as it doesn't really care about other countries, except maybe, oh, they have resources that we want in the really expansionist forms of fascism, like the, you know, mid-century European ones in Italy and Germany. But generally, fascists are inward-looking nationally. They're inward-looking insofar as their belief system is about their country and their people in their time, or about some mythical golden age of their people. It's not about, oh, I believe in these rules for everyone, because universal values are really a liberal idea, and I mean like a classical liberal idea, which a lot of these guys reject. They're not into classical liberalism, so it's not surprising that Bannon, who is an American, is staunchly pro-America, whereas Dugin, who is Russian, favors an anti-Western Russo-Chinese alliance. Because Bannon's thinking about what's best for America in his eyes, and Dugin is thinking about what's best for Russia in his eyes. The hyper-nationalists of Hungary's Jobbik party are often rabidly Islamophobic, because I think they kind of exist on the borderline between what you might call Christendom and the Islamic world, to use some very broad strokes, and see themselves as waging a war in defense of Christendom, while many right-wing mystics find much to admire in the ultra-conservative Islam of René Guénon, who rejects liberalism and embraces a totalizing vision of faith. Now, I don't even want to talk about this, because I heard this guy just moved back in with his mom, and he has no money, and no one cares what he says. So Richard Spencer is more of a joke at this point than he is anyone to be really taken seriously. Still others see emphasizing race as too scientific and insufficiently spiritual, a vulgar concession to modernity that, not coincidentally, helped bring down the Nazis. So they have these shared, or what brings them together is not their shared commitments so much as it is their mutual bête noire, namely modernity. All believe that with the advent of modern liberalism and its permissiveness, pluralism, and materialism, this is going to be a big concept here in just a second. So something fundamental was lost. I don't think that the far right is alone in thinking this, that permissiveness, pluralism, and materialism have indeed taken away something spiritual from the human condition. And you see, I think, with the rise of things like the neo-pagan movements and the kind of modern-day witchcraft movements, the whole New Age thing is like, I think, a reaction against this. Because you've been seeing these movements show up in new, like people creating new religions, like the Theosophical Society is the one that comes most readily to mind. In the 1800s, these are all products of the industrial and now the post-industrial revolution, people reacting against what they see as the kind of crassification of culture in general. The capitalism is eating everything and turning it into a vast consumer wasteland. As George Carlin said, we turn this beautiful continent into a coast-to-coast shopping mall. So more secular variants of traditionalism tend to emphasize a sense of community, belonging, and national purpose. I don't know about national purpose, but from all the things that I have read about human psychology and human history, a sense of community and belonging is an absolutely necessary component of a complete human psychology. What they're talking about is something very real. So you may react against, oh my God, Steve Bannon, evil, or you may react against, they're horrible, they love Hitler, whatever. So I'm sure some of them do, but that's not really the point. The point is they're reacting against a problem that I think does actually exist, which is this lack of a sense of community, lack of a sense of belonging, and most importantly, a sense of meaninglessness. Chris Hedges said the same thing, and Chris Hedges is hardly a Steve Bannon. He's a big left-wing guy, and he was talking about the same thing in reference to the Capitol riots, that people get sucked in to conspiracy theories because they feel like they don't have a sense of meaning. Their life doesn't mean anything. And many times these are people who come from these towns that were abandoned by the coal companies or whatever that gave them their kind of reason for existing. And so as a result, now these places are burned out and abandoned, and these people's lives have lost a sense of meaning. There is no sense of common community, and there is no sense of us taking care of each other, of us being responsible for each other, which I differ with the right-wing people here on this sense of national purpose. A nation is too big to really give you a sense, a true sense of belonging. Inevitably, you end up kind of grafting a fake sense of belonging onto this national community that really is too big. And so more New Agey and mystical brands insist on abandoning materialism and returning to a more spiritually disciplined existence. So as Teitelbaum puts it, modernization, to paint in broad strokes, involves the retreat of public religion in favor of reason. Corresponding to this, it entails a weakening of the symbolic in favor of the literal and a declining interest in things that aren't easily mathematicized and quantified. Spirit, emotions, the supernatural, in favor of those that are, namely, material things. And this represents a repeat of the transition from the Enlightenment era to the Romantic era. You go from thinkers like Locke and Descartes in the 17th and 18th centuries to thinkers like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche in the 19th century, who reject the rationalism of the Enlightenment and embrace something that looks much more romantic. And in general, I know Nietzsche is like, you know, the Nazi philosopher, right? He got bastardized by the Nazis, but he has that same romantic kind of quasi-mystical view of the world that these guys are highlighting in these kind of far-right people. I think that they're highlighting something real. This happens over and over again. An overemphasis on reason creates something that is a little bereft of that human spark that is necessary to the feeling of completeness in the human psychology. And so people react against it, and they try to return to a spiritually disciplined existence, or they insist on abandoning materialism. But anyway, I just want to go to the last paragraph here because, or maybe the last couple paragraphs. So the right-wing populism of figures like Steve Bannon, for instance, excludes huge swaths of workers despite his claims of championing a working-class politics. Compare that to democratic socialism, which offers all workers not just better material conditions, but empowerment, extending basic economic and political rights that neoliberalism has allowed to wither away. What they have done here is to make the same mistake that led to the rise of these people in the first place, which thinks that something basic and material conditions, but also material empowerment, basic economic and political rights, is all, assuming that that's all that people need to be okay. And this is a mistake I think that Marxism and socialism makes all the time, that there really is nothing more to religion than just the opiate of the masses. That indeed there is nothing more to life than just giving people this, that this is a complete sociological or a complete psychological system for a human being. And I think it explains why you see certain people embrace Marxism as if it's a religion, not as if it is a political system. So unfortunately, due to time constraints, that is all the time I can spend on this article. I want to talk about it more, but I can't. So I'm sorry. Let's read some comments. All right. So we have Trump is playing for the crowd. Eugene Debs. Juniper Smoke says Nazis. Yes, indeed. Nazis. I don't remember what this is in reference to, so I'm not sure. I wasn't watching the comments closely. Public Citizen says very strange coalition, though I hope perhaps that looking at this article has given you an idea of what it is that's uniting these people. Public Citizen says, what do they have in common? Probably fear and rage. Yes, a lot of fear and a lot of rage. Yes. But I think this analysis of where that fear and rage comes from is accurate, and we would be well served to pay attention to that fear and rage and not to, like, discount that fear and rage, that we would be well served to listen to these people and find out why they feel the way that they do. And this goes back to the whole, do you shut them down or do you try to like bring people back into the fold? And Public Citizen says spirituality exists in one form or another. Indeed, it does. Now, of course, certain ages put more emphasis on spirituality than do others. And of course, the problem is that many times, because we come from like a Protestant descended worldview, that many times we tend to think of spirituality as a purely individualistic pursuit, when I think there is some legitimacy to considering spirituality also as a collective pursuit, that meaning and belonging, in other words, are intimately tied up together. All right, we are over our time for today, so I must bid you all a fair adieu, and we will be back tomorrow at the same time as we are every weekday from 9 to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday Eastern Standard Time. So go ahead and give us a follow, give us a subscription, depending on what platform you are on. And then, of course, you should also share this video with everyone you know, like it's the unearned wealth of your ancestors, so we can grow and have fun. Oh, this looks good. The left needs to embrace people of faith. Do me a favor, let's talk about this next time, because that is a ripe topic for discussion. So anyway, thank you all very much for watching. This has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.